Good afternoon, or good morning, or good evening, and welcome to the LSE wherever you happen to be in the world. My name is Ricky Verdet. I'm a professor of urban studies, and I am moderating a session organized by LSE Ideas and the Conflict Research Program with a number of speakers who I will introduce. The event is entitled Cities at War, Global Insecurity and Urban Resistance. And it's in the occasion of the publication of this book, which I hope you will all rush out to get and order after the session if you haven't already. The session will last an hour and a half. We will end precisely as required, and we will have a number of presentations, a conversation with all the three panelists, with me and between themselves, and then importantly, the last half an hour or so, we will be taking questions from you. Two logistical points. The first is that there is a hashtag for this event, which you should have already on your information, but it is at LSE Cities at War. And we would like you, encourage you to send us questions through the Q&A system, and those will be fed through to me as moderator. And when we come to that part of the session, I will put to the panelists some, probably not all, of your questions. So thank you very much for attending. Now, the fact that we're talking about cities is nearly a given. It is well known and understood and highly researched subject. Cities at this moment in time have become not only where more people are, but also where greater tensions, but also greater opportunities are concentrated. But of course, the growth of cities around the world and these tensions and opportunities are actually unequally distributed, many in Africa, many in Asia, and it therefore not by chance that some of these phenomena of conflict and tension, which is the subject matter of the research program and the book that comes out, are also concentrated in a number of these areas which are experiencing rapid growth and radical transformation. This book is the effectively output, and we'll hear more from some of the authors and editors in a moment, is part of a project which has lasted roughly 5 or 6 years. It has been based at the LSE for that period of time, as part of really an ongoing project that Mary Caldor has been leading and investigating around the notion of security in transition. The book has, in fact, 9 contributions, apart from essays by the two editors, Mary Caldor and Saskia Sassen, and I think a number of the other authors, except for Ruben, who will be speaking with us today, may be present in the Zoom sphere, so we welcome them, even though we can't actually hear their voices. The book includes case studies, as I've said, in fact, 9 cities from around the world. And if one wants to try and summarize this book, it's from yogurt to tactical urbanism. That sort of weird sentence, which I've just said, will be clarified in a moment, but it's all about trying to understand the dynamics of cities, urban capabilities, as the two editors call it, and how that reflects itself in the dynamics of survival and of being an individual who lives at the heart of these cities in transition and conflict. The two editors of the book and the two first individuals I will ask to speak are well known to many of this audience, and of course, in many ways have created the fields which are being celebrated in this book. Mary Caldor has been at the LSE for a number of years, and even the words of global governance or the notion of civil society are very much authored by her, and not just part of the research program she leads, but the language that is now very much common parlance and have influenced states and nations in the way they think. And the way they do things. And that's an important part of this project. Saskia Sassen, in very similar ways, a parallel but different trajectory, has been a student of cities and how cities are interconnected in terms of networks of people, ideas, and information, more recently has become focused and interested in the notion of expulsions, of extractions, and how cities change and create inequalities, and particularly how cities themselves have a voice and speak back. And Ruben Anderson, who is a professor of social anthropology at Oxford, will explain in a moment some of his ideas and interests around the notions of borders, of mapping inequalities and patterns of violence in cities. So we have two of the editors, one of the contributors to the case study, the authors, and a series of ideas to talk around. So I'd like to start by asking Mary to, in a way, summarize a little bit the project, if you may, and perhaps even the structure of the book, and then to the core ideas that have led you to investigate cities at war. And can I ask you to unmute before you speak, please?
Okay, thank you very much, Ricky, for that introduction. What I thought I'd do was to start with yogurt and why it's relevant. The book starts with a story from Syria. To be precise, from Eastern Ghouta, which is a suburb of Damascus, which was under siege for much of the war and probably suffered more than almost anywhere else. People were literally starving, and it's where the chemical warfare attacks in 2013 took place. In Eastern Ghouta, there is a dairy farm that produces a large part of the milk products, including yogurt, for the city of Damascus. And at the beginning of the war, the dairy farmer made a deal with the Syrian government that they would not bomb his farm, and in exchange, he would continue to supply yogurt to the whole of Damascus. And so actually what happened was that his farm became a safe haven for for people fleeing violence, for displaced people. And in the book, we use this as a metaphor. We call it the yogurt run, and we use it as a metaphor for a tiny opening in ongoing violence that offers some possibility of change. And that's in a way what we mean by urban capabilities. I'm going to give you one more example of this. It's actually not from the book, but it's an example I'm very fond of. And it's also from Syria. It's from Aleppo. So Aleppo was divided between a government part, an Islamist part controlled by Jabhat al-Nusra, and then an ISIS part. And the government controlled the supply of electricity. The main water installation was in the part held by Jabhat al-Nusra, and ISIS controlled the supply of diesel oil. So a group of engineers who wanted to keep the infrastructure going in Aleppo, who wanted to be able to mend water pipes and gas pipes, keep electricity going, literally formed themselves as a group called People of Aleppo and went around negotiating with all these different groups in order to keep these basic services going. And indeed, when Jabhat al-Nusra finally withdrew, they said they would not hand over the water installation to the government. They would only hand it over to the people of Aleppo. So this is another sort of example of how of urban capabilities. And Saskia will talk much more about that when I've finished. I wanted to start, Ricky mentioned that this book is the outcome of a project which was part of a program funded by the European Research Council called Security in Transition. And our fundamental question we asked in this program was, in large parts of the world, people are deeply insecure, whether they're insecure from extreme poverty, from physical violence, from rape, looting, all of these kinds of things, killing, forced displacement. And yet at the same time, our security capabilities, things like military forces and intelligence services, seem completely incapable of addressing this. And we called it the security gap. And we said we want to study the problem of the of security from this perspective in a weird way. Security means, on the one hand, safety for people, that's the objective. But on the other hand, we use it to refer to a set of practices, whether it's military forces and police forces. And these two meanings don't actually fit together. So we said we're going to treat this as a kind of conceptual framework, which we will study through different dimensions. And one of the dimensions we wanted to study was geographies. One of the dimensions is what happens in cities. And for that, I asked Saskia, because she was the person who writes so marvelously about cities, if she would come and help us. And what was sort of really exciting was that we had in our program lots of people in different places doing field work, and we asked them to focus on insecurity in the cities and at the same time look at the kind of security practices and whether they contribute to security or insecurity. And Saskia's insight, Saskia always said to us, cities talk back. And so what we wanted to do was to look at the city from the perspective of people living in it to get a sort of better, more granular understanding of this problem. So that's what the book is about. What are our main findings? I'll be fairly brief, but we can continue to discuss them because I don't want to take up too much time. I mean, the first finding is that contemporary wars tend to be urban. Doesn't mean that rural insurgencies don't happen, but on the whole, war now is much more urban than ever before. And part of the reason for that is simply that cities are bigger than ever they were before. They now comprise more than half of the world's population now live in cities. And actually, wars contribute to the growth of cities, because people expelled from their homes tend to congregate in cities. So we know lots of cities, one of which is in the book Goma in eastern Congo, but lots of cities, Kabul is another, that have hugely expanded as a consequence of war. But this is a big contrast to traditional wars, which were largely fought in the countryside. In sort of classic interstate wars, the instructions were always, the tactical and strategic instructions were always to avoid cities. All the famous strategists from Clausewitz to Sun Yat-sen said avoid cities. And battles were kind of set pieces, and we talk about battlefields because they took place in fields. Equally, classic insurgencies and rebellions tended to take place in jungles and mountains. That's where people like Che Guevara or Mao Zedong hid or tried to find a build kind of safe havens. Of course, this began to change in the Second World War, which could be treated as a kind of transition. And then after the war, in places like Algiers or Hue or in Vietnam, those kinds. But now I think it is cities predominantly in which warfare takes place, and the built environment becomes the kind of equivalent of jungles and mountains where combatants can hide. Schools and hospitals too. So what are the sort of key aspects of contemporary war that are affected by cities and that are demonstrated in our various chapters? I think the first is, and this is a point that Saskia makes too, the people who fight contemporary wars tend to be networks of state and non-state actors who are both global and local. And so the global infrastructure of cities, a point that Saskia makes in her book on growth, is terribly important for these networks. So that's one very important reason. It's a network of communications, digitalization, but also finance. So you find Syrian warlords now actually investing in London property, for example. The second aspect has to do with the narratives. These kinds of wars are very much fought in the name of identity, whether it's religious identity, Shia or Sunni. That this may not be the cause of war, but they get to be framed. That's how the networks identify themselves. And in fact, identities get entrenched by war. Once you've started to kill somebody in the name of identity, then the sort of polarization that maybe didn't exist before does exist now. So it might be Shia or Sunni, it might be national Serb or Croat, and so on. And what's interesting is that in the past, cities were, we always thought of cities as cosmopolitan places. We thought of cities where people come together. But what has happened, perhaps as a consequence, both cause and consequence of war, as cities become huge, we get an increasing degree of ghettoization, and different groups congregate in different areas and they become home. And so rural immigrants, you know, find that they're, you know, that they can find help and support from their local identity groups. And that gets kind of entrenched in cities and exacerbated by war where they find protection. A third point is that contemporary wars are directed against civilians. Most of the violence is against civilians rather than between warring groups. And sometimes that means deliberate attacks. Partly because you don't know the difference between civilians and combatants. When the Russians and Americans bomb schools and hospitals, they say it's because there are civilians there, there are combatants there, but who knows whether there are combatants or not. And, some authors refer to contemporary wars actually as herbicide, because there are attacks against the very fabric of the city. And finally, there's an issue of how contemporary wars are financed, that actually, unlike traditional wars, which were financed by taxation, they're increasingly financed by the informal economy, which is to do with looting, pillage, criminalization, and all of these things. And again, these sorts of activities happen in the cities. So one set of findings is obviously just about the fact that wars are more urban than they were in the past. A second set of findings has to do with the way that these kinds of wars are overlaid by global security institutions, global security interventions. And one of the things that came out of our security and transition research program was the idea that we could talk about security cultures as ways of doing security, security practices in which somehow objectives and practices are linked. And I just, for the purpose of today, I just want to mention two. One is the war on terror, which is essentially the war of the manhunt. It's a war against individual terrorists. And the security forces involved are special forces, private security contractors, drones, airstrikes. That's one kind of security practice, but another one is what we're calling the liberal peace, which is what the UN does. The huge growth of multilateral operations in all conflict zones, which involve NGOs, different UN agencies, peacekeepers, and so on. These conglomerations or assemblages, using Saskia's language, of international assemblages. And they operate in very different ways. They're supposed to be stabilizing. They aren't necessarily, and we could talk about why not, but nevertheless, they're a big improvement on the war on terror. And in many of our cities, we find the presence of these global interventions. And that's how we've looked at the differences in cities, because the worst violence is to be found where you have the combination of the war on terror and the liberal peace and the new wars. And there are three cities with which we begin the book, and Rubin's going to talk about one of them: Bamako, Baghdad, and Kabul. There are also cities where you see the war on terror interacting with local violence. And in the book, these are Karachi and Ciudad Juarez on the border between the US and Mexico. And then we have one city where it's only the liberal presence, which is really fascinating, which is Goma in eastern Congo, which has become a sort of safe haven, not only for armed groups, but also for refugees and displaced people. And it's grown enormously as a consequence of the Congolese war and the liberal peace presence. And then finally, we look at two cities, which are actually the most peaceful cities in our study, where neither of these external interventions are present. One is Bogota in Colombia, which has explicitly had its own civic security policy. And the other, which is fascinating and not very well known, is Novi Pazar, which is a Muslim city in Serbia, which despite all the wars in the former Yugoslavia, managed to escape war. And it was mainly because of the resistance of the citizens in the city themselves, despite the fact that they face awful problems, partly because of the economic pressures as a result of neoliberalism, and partly because of the huge influx of refugees and displaced people into this safe city. So those are the sort of key findings from the book. And then finally, of course, we talk about the implications of this. We talk about the importance of urban capabilities, and we talk about how it's this kind of, as Ricky said, tactical urbanism that offers the greatest opportunity for alternative security approaches. And with that, I will hand over to Saskia.
Well, just one second, because I know, Saskia, you've had a bit of a technical problem, so we're delighted to see you back. But so first of all, I want to make sure, can you hear us? And would you like to follow on from that, or gather yourself for a few minutes and we can go to Ruben? But can you hear us? And if so, can you unmute and pick up where Mary left? But are you happy to go on? Are you settled?
Yes, absolutely. Can you hear me well?
Yes, we can.
Yes. Okay, very good. Well, Mary, of course, gave you just a wonderful description of some of the elements. And also you can see how here we were talking about war, but cities become these major presences, these major conditions. And of course, that also captures, and for me, this was of great interest, the fact that the urbanizing of wars, you know, when you think of the 1900s, oceans, you know, big open spaces, those were the theaters of war. And today that has changed in many ways also, luckily. So I just got quite involved with the war aspect. I, who really do not do war, that is not my subject, but I was really engaged, and I found that the work that Mary and her whole team, which was really a wonderful group of people, were doing, was sort of opening a whole new vista. And in many ways, war, I think, Mary, if I'm right, war was the main category in play for your team, whereas for me, of course, it became the spaces, the particular spaces, cities, urban settings, where these wars were happening. You know, there was an interesting sort of just a slight different point of entry into the subject. And I learned an enormous amount, much more about war than I ever thought I would. Now, one sort of major element that people often sort of are not even aware of is the extent to which people made cities. It was more people. Yes, of course, there were kings and there were all kinds of other things, but this was a necessary condition. This is not a willful project of some fancy blah, blah. Cities become these absolutely necessary spaces. Now, in our current condition, we just don't see that, you know, we don't, and they are less necessary in many ways than they were when these cities begin to get built. And to me, then there is also this older history that is interesting to recover, you know, why cities? Again, I repeat, today, the city has a rather different set of meanings from that original condition, which was the city was a protected zone in many ways. And so when Mary asked me to join, you know, I mean, I joined quite late, given that this was a major project. I was really quite interested in learning more about the question of violence and war and the ways in which that instantiates in the urban condition. That became my contribution, if you want, you know, to remind us that cities are these major, very significant places, and there are different historical periods, clearly, where they play different roles. Now, the title of this project, Cities at War, you know, of course, war is probably the big word in there for many a reader. I think what Mary's team showed, the research they did, and there were a good number of excellent researchers, was the extent to which the urban condition is not just, we cannot just think of it as cities. The urban condition is a condition that can also take formats that we do not necessarily associate today with cities, but it's like a protected zone. It's a zone where everything can mix in ways that in the palace or in a little rural village, it doesn't all mix. Parts of that are not present in the zone. And then of course, finally, this whole notion of cities and war. I mean, the typical urbanist does not quite, except if you are describing, say, you know, destroyed cities in history, but the notion that war is today possibly, partly, etc., present in cities is another condition. Now, I remember when we had the attacks on the towers in New York, when they closed up the whole area where I happened to live, around that where the towers had happened, and where the destruction had happened. And suddenly there was a silence. I will never forget that. Silence, and we would run into other people, of course, and all the sounds of the city were gone because no cars were allowed in this particular big zone around where the towers were. And that was also a very peculiar condition, because then you realize cities are not about silence. Cities are about a multiplication of sounds and voices. And so for me, it became a rather interesting experience to join this wonderful team who had been doing for years extraordinarily serious research on major cities. And I sort of brought to that, I guess, my imaginaries and my experiences. And I'm just so grateful that Mary brought me in, because it really, I really learned something. I learned something that I thought I knew about, and it was something different, a different aspect of the urban condition.
Perhaps, Saskia, we can come back to, you know, the connection between the point you've just made about the city and its multiple voices, and not all of them. Saskia, are you still speaking?
Yeah, no, I'm not. Oh, you didn't hear me?
No, I think we just lost the last few seconds, but...
Oh, okay. No, I'm done. I'm done.
Okay. The point I was making is that I think it would be useful maybe to come back in a moment and link what you were just saying about the notion of a city having voice or multiple voices, many of them not apparent to the eye, and mm-hmm. the notion of urban capabilities, because I think you have a very sort of multi-leveled interpretation of what that means. But before that, I would like to turn to, as Mary said, to one of the authors, yeah. Ruben Anderson. In fact, I understand Ruben a bit more than an author. I think you played also quite an important yeah. role in putting this project together, even in your time at the LSE as a research fellow.
I was on the sidelines, if nothing else.
But it would be interesting if you could talk a little bit about some of the issues that you raise in your chapter about Mali. You look at the capital city and the way it's been, inverted commas, invaded by interveners, by in this case UN agencies and others, and the impact that has had on cohesion or non-cohesion, in fact, with local communities, exactly those there that are supposedly there to help and assist. So perhaps you could talk about that. And for me, as a urbanist, your fascinating reflections on the notion of mapping or remapping zones of violence and conflict.
Well, thank you, Ricky, and Mary and Saskia, of course, for making this session happen. And special thanks to, of course, Mary and Saskia, the editors of this wonderful book. I hope we can see some of our colleagues in some shape or form, either during the event or perhaps some way after it. But we had a wonderful team working on this. And I think already from your comments, Mary and Saskia, we're getting a very strong sense here of the particular contribution of this book, understanding cities at war, the role of cities in wider security landscapes, if you will. I came to this project just by way of background from another project of my own, looking at those wider security landscapes. I was very much interested at the time working with Mary at LSE in considering the mapping of global danger, if you will, the global high-risk red zones and the green zones, how they rubbed up against one another, who played a role in that kind of mapping of the world of military aid and border intervention? How was that distance maintained between the red zone and the green zone through borders, bunkers, remote controls, drones, and so on? And how can we understand those changes, that mapping, on a very granular level, on a very ethnographic level, in everyday interventions, including in cities, of course, the walls of bunkers, the gates of UN compounds, the technologies used to monitor distant areas of military intervention, and the division of labor between headquartered expats in the field and those on the front line bearing the brunt of the violence and insecurity, who were often local or regional, and in my case in Mali, African aid keepers. And so that's where I came to this project, looking at the conflict in Mali in West Africa and the wider Sahel region, which has clearly become a spotlight for many interveners in recent years, Western and European interveners in particular, also as regards migration and bordering, as well as counter-terror. So I visited Bamako in 2014 for this project, feeding into this book. With this idea of going down to that granular everyday level, understanding the everyday life of interveners, the four-wheel drives, the gates of compounds, the circuit of aid workers and military interveners, and linking that up to the wider geopolitics, the wider mapping and intervention. And what I think this project really brought to the fore for me, and I think for the other contributors to this book, is really that mid-range scale there that I certainly was somehow missing, between that granular everyday and the geopolitical, the urban scale, the city and how the city itself, in a way, as Saskia puts it, speaks back to these interventions, these ways of trying to change its fabric and its role in conflicts and wider security landscapes. So I think the project really contributed, and this book really shows that. How by thinking about that scale of the urban, bringing that urban map into the picture, alongside the geopolitical one perhaps, really may change our view, our lens on these conflicts and these insecurities. So what did I find in Bamako? Well, on my first day back in the city, I'd known it from earlier years when it was a pretty sleepy, large capital city in West Africa, sometimes referred to as the world's largest village. I already saw change as soon as I came into the city with a taxi. Around the French embassy, right in the center of town, big anti-blast, so-called HESCO bastions had now been erected. First use around military compounds in Afghanistan. Big sand-filled boxes essentially jutting out onto the road, pushing local drivers out of the way, and really giving a whole different military flavor to this urban landscape of markets and trafficked streets. A few further roads down the block, if you will, was a UN peacekeeping mission, MINUSMA, which had set up shop in a big five-star hotel, at least five-star on paper, where a tank pointed out towards the road, big bollards blocked the passage, and a line of UN four-wheel drives, sort of sheeted cocoons of the international interveners, the liberal peace interveners, as Mary calls them, again, blocking the traffic of locals and lending that whole different flavor to the urban landscape of Mali. I saw the same with NGOs, with maps on the walls showing all of Mali essentially a red zone, only daytime streets within the capital were areas where you could go. Everything else was a no-go zone, essentially. And everyone was withdrawing into their cocoon, their bunker, whether they were aid workers, border officials, counter-terror operatives, peacekeepers, they were all holed up in Bamako headquarters, and all of them were trying to intervene at a distance of what's happening up in northern Mali, very far away from the capital, where conflict was playing out among jihadist groups, insurgents, and international interveners and Malian forces. So Bamako, in a way, is an odd one out in this book because it wasn't the site of conflict per se. In fact, it was precisely because it was seen as relatively risk-free that all the international interveners had set up shop there, drawing in a sense on the urban capabilities of Bamako. To do so, as we heard already, there's a benefit here to the infrastructure of cities in how interveners locate their interventions in the geographies, in the specific landscape, in this case of Mali, but similarly so in many other countries. And intervening then at a distance was something very different was going on, the violence, the insecurity, haunting the north and eventually the central part of the vast territory of Mali. But what I saw within the city was, on the one hand, a distancing between those interveners and local life, and on the one hand, on the other hand, rapprochement among the interveners themselves. So let me just say a couple of words about that and then I conclude. So the bunkers and the various risk-averse operations of the interveners had really put them at one remove from local life. And this was a striking difference to me to earlier years, when development aid officials had come into Mali, the expat scene, if you will, of the capital was very different. People were interacting across those social divides, locals and intervener or expat, what have you. Now with these new templates of intervention, these security bollards and barriers, these risk protocols and bunkers, we're really putting a huge distance between the local world and the world of intervention, as if a second layer of the urban geography had been superimposed upon the city that I knew from earlier visits and that locals knew and still kept on using. On the other hand, interveners themselves were increasingly moving through the same circuit. The distance was shrinking between aid workers, humanitarians, border officials, counter-terror operatives, peacekeepers, a very curious and perhaps dangerous mixing of these different fields on the nighttime circuit of Bamako, behind those closed walls of restaurants and bars, which tragically were also to become sites of attacks in the years after I left on the interveners. So there was a city of risk here, if you will, superimposed on the everyday city of Bamako, through which interveners were drawing on the capabilities, if you will, or the infrastructures and capabilities of Bamako to stage this distanced intervention in the north of the country. But on the other hand, there were also those everyday capabilities that Saskia and Mary bring out so well, including in the introduction to the book. Everyday life was ongoing. Malian locals, citizens of Bamako, had been taking in internally displaced, as we heard also from Mary, to their homes, to their compounds, to their courtyards, often not even necessarily along ethnic or identitarian lines. There was a clear civic and urban capability here within the city and within Mali as a whole that was still very much in play, and that you saw every day just walking around the streets of Bamako or catching the shared so-called Sotrama vans that kept plying the central markets. There were also capabilities in another sense in which the city spoke back through protests against international presence, with locals staging loud political protests in front of those bastions and bollards of the UN and the French embassy, saying that they did not want this kind of intervention on their territory, this kind of distanced security intervention that protesters were saying were not serving the people of Mali. So the very geography of security and risk that had been superimposed on Mali also became the stage for a counter movement, another way for the city to speak back. And perhaps there are some good lessons here for thinking through how the city, that mid-range scale, if you will, that certainly I, in my work, this book really helped bring to the fore, and I think for other authors as well, can help us both analytically and in terms of perhaps practical political ways forward, or thinking through the civic city, the civic dimensions through which some of these security and insecurity landscapes can be changed fundamentally.
Ruben, thank you for that. I mean, what is clear just from the level of detail that Ruben has just been describing in the case of Mali, and this comes out from other chapters in the book, for example, the following one on Kabul raises sort of similar issues where the same set of people interact completely differently in different ways. And I think that's one of the big lessons that comes out. There's not one dimensional way of reading cities. I mean, the point you just made very briefly, Ruben, of let's call it the local communities actually welcoming and hosting the displaced people, families. There's a detail of a family squatting for over 12 months and being completely accommodated while you turn on the same street and you find these pieces of fencing which came from Kabul, which actually doesn't make that connection possible. I found that powerful, and I found it in many of the essays coming through at that level of, as we say, granular detail. I mean, Saskia, just going back, as Ruben has just mentioned there, that is evidence of urban capabilities in the way I think that you would understand them. And I think maybe also with Mary, what's the distinction, if any, between urban and civic capabilities? Because the term is used often. Maybe it's exchanged freely, but why don't we start with you, Saskia, on the urban capabilities and then to Mary. Please unmute Saskia, though. Saskia, unmute, please.
Yes, well, you raised some very nice points. It's a pleasure to talk about these. And again, this was such a collective project. Well, I think that by using the term capabilities, for me, that opened up a different type of window into the city than the usual one, which is agglomeration, you know, et cetera, traffic, and you know, good and bad things. So the larger issue then also is, how do we produce capabilities? You know, we produce capabilities, we humans, we cities, we empires, we, in many diverse ways. Many of those ways are finished today. But the city, that is not finished. That is, on the contrary, becoming a more and more significant actor. Why? Because it combines sort of the basics of any structure in a way that other formats can't do. It also means that if you work on cities, you are forever working on an element that is a wild animal that can change any day in some of its aspects. You know, it's not a finished product. The real sense that you get when you are in a city is that this is one moment in this city's life, and it happens to be the moment that I'm here, but that in fact, who knows what all the other instantiations in the, of that same city have been across time. And so what I really liked in this project was precisely that mix of elements, the now, the very concreteness of the now moment in any of those cities that were affected by war conditions, and how they managed to survive. It also tells you that the story of cities is a story of people intervening. This is not a story of palaces where the people just go to clean or to watch the beauties. No, no, the city are, and the people are an essential element in a working city. Now, in today's major, major cities, I must say, we have entered a new domain. And that needs to be analyzed. I think we need to do some work on capturing what is the condition today, you know, in these major cities. How can we make it better? There are some very, very serious issues that we need to address. I don't want to romanticize the city, in other words. I just want to capture, number one, its capacity for a very long life, extraordinarily long lives. And on the other hand, all the problems that come with that, the inequalities that are part of this story.
Perfect.
So anyhow, I must say, I was a late arrival at the project, and it really is the project of Mary and the whole team that she had. So
Mary.
I'm just so glad that I had a chance to participate in this. I'm really grateful.
Well, Saskia says she's a late arrival, but honestly, Urban Capabilities was her idea. And she was inspirational for all of us. So honestly, we're a kind of mutual admiration society, you and me, Saskia. But I wanted to answer Ricky's question, because it's a really interesting question to me, because in my current program, the Conflict Research Program, we have very much built up the use of the term civicness as what we call a logic of public authority. And actually, I'll tell you why it's important in a moment, but let me just say something about what we mean by it. Undoubtedly, the etymology of civicness comes from the city. And, you know, the kind of constitutional secular order, law-based order, that first emerged in city states. And Saskia describes wonderfully in her book on territorial authority how it kind of jumped to the state. But that's what we mean by civicness, whereas actually how public authority functions in most conflict zones is not civic at all. It's often based on money, sort of crony capitalism, what my colleague Alex DeWall calls the political marketplace. And it's also based on extremist identity politics. The idea that religious networks or ethnic networks somehow control the state. So civicness is an alternative logic. But it's also a form of behavior and a form of resistance. I mean, as behavior, what we find in all our conflict zones is that there are people who behave in civic ways despite the war. There are doctors and nurses in Iraq, for example, who refuse to base their healthcare on ethnic criteria. They obey the Hippocratic Oath and they give that healthcare to whoever needs it. There are civil servants who really do try to provide public services rather than to see it as a source of money. And we can go on with the list of that kind of behavior, but there's also resistance. There's also protests by people who refuse both corruption and identity politics. In Iraq, there have been big demonstrations and their slogan has been, in the name of religion, they are looting us. It's very interesting. We've been writing a lot about civicness. And if you go back to the history of the term, you know, we find there's a notion of what you might call civic humanism, which was very much not a rejection of religion as such, but a demand for non-religiously based governance, for secular, but not extremist secular behavior. There was the notion of civic virtue, which was also against corruption, acting in the public interest. And finally, we have the notion of civic nationalism, which is kind of an inclusive kind of nationalism as opposed to an exclusive identity-based nationalism. So we find the term very useful, and it is similar to urban capabilities, although it's not necessarily confined to the city, because it's a way of trying to explain to policymakers, and policymakers tend to think civil society is a good thing and we should give them money and we should support NGOs, but they don't realize that civicness is the only way out of conflict. It's the only way out of violence. And therefore civic actors need to be their partners if what they're interested in is conflict stabilization. They may not be. They may be interested in making money, or they may be interested in geopolitics, as is the case for, you know, Russian or Iranian or American intervention in Syria. But if you're talking to Swedish donors or to even are in the UK too, the DFID, which has now become FCDO, or independent donors, then this idea that civicness is a sort of crucial component of any method of dealing with conflict is hugely important. One other issue, because I've talked rather at length, I mean, one of the things that really struck me in Saskia's work was her argument that cities are the level at which you address global problems, you know, whether it's climate change or other big issues. And that could not be more true in the case of war. Again, what we find in all our work is one of the fascinating aspects of contemporary wars is the prevalence of local peace agreements. You know, contemporary wars, because of all the things I said earlier, are very decentralized and fragmented. And there are lots of areas like Novi Pazar, but even where actually local people make agreements. Now, not all of these are good agreements. Some of them are surrenders. Some of them are agreements about infrastructure. Some of them are truces, so armed groups can improve their positions. But where there's a substantial involvement of citizens, they tend to be real peace agreements, but they're not taken that seriously by the international community, which tends always to focus on the national level. And of course, we have examples, particularly from Colombia, like Medellin and Bogota, where, if you like, civic peace projects involving policing, involving urban improvements have been hugely important as a way of reducing violence.
Thank you. When you've mentioned Novi Pazar a couple of times, and one outstanding narrative which comes out from that chapter in the book is that effectively a number of businessmen got together made sure by talking to the commanders from the different military groups that they would not destroy their city so that they could keep their business going. And I think that's an interesting aspect. And that's
hugely important in all the other places. I mean, particularly businesses that are independent of the state. I mean, some businesses are crony capitalists and get state contracts and are dependent on state contracts. But in Syria, there's a whole business class, a medium and small businessmen, that are hugely important civic element. And actually another wonderful example is the city of Hama in Syria, where there was one family of 10 brothers, 9 were businessmen, and 1 was a sheikh who supported the opposition. And they got together at the beginning of the war and were determined to keep the war out of Hama. And they negotiated with both government and opposition forces to keep them out. So it's a very, very similar story.
Saskia, I think we may have lost a little bit of what you were saying earlier. So apologies for that. But perhaps you could just pick up before we start taking in the Q&A from the audience. There are quite a few piling up, but keep on sending them in, please. Saskia, perhaps we might want to go back to this critical issue that you have raised and Mary repeated, that in the end, cities are the location of global circuits of very, very different levels, whether it's business, whether it's technology, whether it's information. Perhaps you already mentioned that, but we lost you. So can you come back to that issue for us and please unmute? So Saskia, I hope you can hear me.
Yeah, okay. Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay. So when we think about it, most of what we make, what we build up, what we construct, etc., intersects in one way or another with elements that are best produced, designed, imagined, proposed, fought for in complex spaces. And cities are sort of the queen of the domain when it comes to complex mixed spaces. Now, that does not mean that many, many, many cities really are very quiet and very, very reassuring domains where not much happens, where boredom is the name of the game, really. And that is also part of, I think, the human condition, that we want to be left alone, we want tranquility, we want the familiar. So I have mostly focused on major cities, which are really powerhouses, where a lot of the innovations, in one moment or another, of the production of those innovations happens in cities. They need the mix of intelligences. They need the mix of tools, you know, instruments that can be available in a city. So a city is a really interesting condition when you think about it in those terms. You know, it's not just people like to live in cities or people need to live in cities. It's that it is a site for innovations where you can test your innovations very easily with other parties to see whether everything is going fine. You know, it is a very, very, I think, special kind of space. And when you look at antiquity, for me, the interesting thing is also that in antiquity, you already had the need for certain mixes of knowledge. That's one way of putting it, where you needed an urban space. Now, remember that many of the big palaces and all of that were done in big open fields, etc. There was, but sooner or later, when that was the case, you would see an agglomeration of all kinds of activities around it, and with different names, the marketplace or whatever. And so in that sense, it is, of all the major innovations, the major inventions that we have done, a lot of what is most sort of significant in our little histories often has to do with that mix that the urban condition provides. Now, I just want to, final little point, I am not saying that cities are idyllic spaces. Cities are sites for all kinds of combats, and there is no doubt about that. They are not always dressed in the clothing of war, but there's quite a bit of competition, quite a bit of eliminating the other guy or whatever. So they're not sanctuaries, but they are the best sanctuary that we humans have actually produced, you know, when all is said and done. That is sort of one way of putting it. Perhaps I should stop Ricky now talking, or?
Well, I think—
you can't hear me?
Yes, we can, thank you. And that was very clear. We've now received a number of questions from the audience. And in a moment, I will read out one or two. Saskia, Are you still speaking?
No.
Okay, I think something with the technology of Saskia's screen is going funny, but we will continue. And what I'm going to suggest is that I read out one or two questions and ask any of you really to respond to the questions. But the first one is from Lorenzo Giuliani, who is a student in the University of Turin. And he says, Professor Caldo mentions that multiple identities characterize modern cities. And he then says, how is it possible to transform this issue of multiple identities from a risk factor into an opportunity to strengthen the links between different identities? Does it depend only on the behavior of the political elites, or is it up to them? So perhaps, Mary, you want to start on that?
Well, of course it partly has to do with the behavior of the political elites, and it very much has to do with violence. I mean, I do think cities are naturally cosmopolitan. And people have to cooperate in cities. And, you know, if we talk about urban capabilities, they involve necessarily cooperation with people among people from different backgrounds, and people from different backgrounds, from different villages, which may be very ethnically pure, they come to the towns and they find themselves in a mix. And it actually is the combination of political rhetoric, the use of media, especially social media, and most importantly, violence, that divides cities. You know, if I think about our own case in the UK, Northern Ireland, Dublin went through a process very similar to Sarajevo or Baghdad. Dublin was a mixed city, and it was the violence of the period 1968 to 72 that led literally to ethnic cleansing, to the division of the town into Protestant and Catholic areas, and to the building of walls around those areas. But even in the middle of war, people find ways to cross walls. I mean, actually, cosmopolitanism has a tendency to bounce back. Mm-hmm. And my own view is that one of the reasons for the persistence of violence, among other reasons, is that it does bounce back, particularly in cities. And military or political entrepreneurs who require this ethnic purity have to restart tensions and fear in order to keep it going.
On that point, Mary, there's a question which really follows on from that, which maybe you, Ruben, may want to respond. And it's from Anna Sikuraki, who wants to ask whether cities like Kabul, that have changed dramatically by constant warfare, will ever go back to their previous state. I mean, what you just said about Dublin and change there is something which I think is relevant, but also, Ruben, you were also alluding to the Kabul infrastructure sort of brought into the cities that you've studied. Do you want to perhaps respond to this question of can cities ever go back?
I'm sure Mary and Saskia can as well, but let me just say a couple of words in lieu of our dear colleague Florian Weigand, who might be here today, who wrote our chapter on Kabul. And it would be very interesting to have Florian's view in this conversation. Kabul clearly has gone much further than Bamako down this road of militarization, security compounds, and escalating violence at the same time than Bamako has, that I looked at in Mali. I sometimes fear using the word, but I think there's a certain resilience to that urban fabric that certainly we could see in Mali and in Bamako. I can very well imagine 10 years from now, the city bouncing back to some version of its previous shape in a way that superimposition of a world of security and intervention could one day disappear and we would see something quite else entirely. But I think perhaps Kabul is a rather more difficult nut to crack. And I think the example Mary brought in from from Belfast, perhaps, or other cities that have come back, or at least shifted shape over time, provide perhaps clearer indications of where that might go in different directions, depending on each urban and historical context in which these conflicts play out.
Mary, do you just want to also reflect on that before I pass this?
Yes, I mean, I think the cities will never go back to what they were like before because of the huge agglomeration of new people. But whether in the end the division between the green zone and the red zone, you know, will disappear, I think that is entirely possible. I mean, we can imagine these are known as endless wars, forever wars, and the international presence stays for years and years and years. But, and that may be the case. But if we are serious about our argument that these wars can be addressed and they should be addressed at the level of the cities, then overcoming the division between the red zone and the green zone is hugely important. You know, one of the things I was, and I know Rubin thinks this, but one of the things that struck me when Rubin was talking was the weird thing nowadays is that professional soldiers are the most risk-averse people. They're the people who get the most protection. They're protected in their enclaves, while ordinary people are in the streets of Kabul, vulnerable to bombs, being splashed by mud by the soldiers who go along in armored cars. I mean, it's a very weird upside down world we're living in. If you look at the numbers of deaths in wars, it's the regular soldiers who suffer the least.
I think the last comments not reflect a very important issue of scale. And I think the point you've just made, Mary, is these cities are changing not just in terms of their infrastructure and the violence imposed on different constituencies, but literally scale. Some of them are growing, and Saskia, of course, has both mentioned this here and written about it, that not only are they growing, but they're growing asymmetrically, they're growing unequally. And one of the questions, which is from Aldi, from the Charles University in Prague, asks a question to you, Saskia, or relates to the point that you've made, that cities are constantly changing organisms, and that this goes, it's the same for both formal and informal economies of these cities. And the question is, will stronger, more rigid laws and regulations on informal hot points kill, as he says it, these war incentives without even being born? So I don't know whether...
Right. Shall I?
Yeah.
Yeah. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes. Yes. I do think, thinking now of Latin America, where I grew up, we have cities that are monsters. The ones who suffer are not the rich who live in the center. The ones who suffer are the workers who have to travel for 2 hours to get to the city. So there is a kind of a privilege function in play in these types of cities, which is not seen as such. The rich experience their cities as wonderful spaces. They have zero complaints. What they leave out, they don't even think about it, because I have tested some of these people, is that, but you realize that your worker had to travel for 2 hours coming in if the traffic was good, and et cetera, and then 2 hours going back, and they have families. You know, it's like, oh, they hadn't even thought about it. That struck me. In other words, when you are comfortable in a city, you really know how to enjoy what it gives you. And you don't think too much about some of the actors who have to travel for hours to get that work done and earn their money. You know, so that is why I really object to this endless expansion of cities, because the price is paid by the poor. And I find that unjust. And in the long run, it's just absolutely not acceptable. We need to build more cities. When I mention this to people generally, when I say, you know what, we need to build more cities, they look at me stunned. The idea we're going to build cities? It's like that belongs to the past. We don't think today very much, except maybe in certain some parts of the world, we don't think very much about building new cities. We just don't. Or they are private cities, you know, which are barely cities. So that to me is also an interesting point of this current moment, that people are waking up to the possibility, you know what? We need to build more cities rather than keep expanding these cities endlessly. The only winners of that big expansion of cities are those, the privileged, like ourselves, who live in very good parts of the city. But in principle, we really need to build more cities, urgently in some cases.
If I, as chair, am allowed to just interject.
Yes, you are.
It's fine to build more cities, but not like we're building them now.
Now, that's the other point. Yes, absolutely right. I completely agree. But there are certain innovations that are happening where the cities are, the concepts are the good concepts, but not the way we have done it, right?
So just moving away from the urban a little bit and back to some of the points that Mary had made before. There's a question from Lucy Smith, who is a student in migration studies at Oxford. And she wants to hear a bit more about the issue of civic engagement. She said she'd be interested in learning more about your thoughts on the conditions of success for military intervention in contemporary warfare. In other words, what leads to a peaceful resolution or post-conflict capacity building?
Well, first of all, I wonder whether we should call it military intervention. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think international intervention is inevitable. And the question is, what kind of intervention? Are we talking about classic military intervention of the kind that is happening now in Syria by numerous countries? Actually, at the last count, I made it 75. Are we talking about peacekeeping intervention, which is sort of the liberal peace intervention? Are we talking about civic interventions? Are we talking about links among civil society? So I think we need to have intervention, but the question is what kind of intervention? And it seems to me that civic intervention is what we need. It doesn't necessarily mean that there wouldn't be any element of force. We might need policing. And it might be quite robust policing. But the issue really is about what it would do, what would be the aim. And the aim would be not to attack enemies, but to create safe spaces where civilians can be safe. And not only create safe spaces, but actually do more than create safe spaces. I mean, one interesting innovation in one of our sites is the civilian protection sites in South Sudan, where people rushed into the UN compounds when fighting started. And the UN, instead of expelling them, said they could stay. And there are now these protection of civilian sites all over in South Sudan. But they're quite difficult, dangerous places. The question is, what do you do inside these sites? How do you establish legitimate forms of economic activity, for example? How do you establish forms of justice that is hugely important? So these are all forms of civic intervention. On the issue of civic engagement, I think what's really interesting is that we find civic activities everywhere in conflict zones. But where you do get international civic engagement, it turns out you really can make a difference. I mean, one of the studies in our current program is of the civil society room at the international peace talks of the United Nations, which is an innovation by the United Nations. And the significance of this is partly to do with the political process and the role of citizens, but that's rather minor. The significance of this is that it's hugely, it's helped to legitimize the role of civic groups on the ground. And it's also helped to make links. I mean, because these people come to Geneva for the talks, they meet the Red Cross or they meet other international agencies, and they can say, well, we need your, this really happened, by the way, we need your presence in a particular place because it's about to be under attack. And just the international presence can create a form of protection. So when we're thinking about how to deal with conflicts of the type we've been talking about, we tend to think either military intervention on one side or another, or we tend to think of top-down peace talks. A lot of it is somehow intervening in the ecosystem of conflict, creating, trying to create larger and larger spaces where people can live normal lives.
And this, of course, is where urban capabilities kick in.
Exactly. So it's sort of building on urban capabilities, which we find everywhere, but realizing they're the solution, not just something that's helpful.
Yeah.
Now, Saskia, I think you used the phrase right at the beginning about that in the end, cities create spaces, the necessary spaces for survival. Maybe even refuge, but not negative spaces. By the way, one of the comments from Tbilisi a little bit is telling all of you off, saying, sort of saying, look, come on, guys. It seems that cities that look like peaceful places, actually, there's a lot of war actually happening under the surface. In other words, one thing is what is apparent to the eye, and another thing is what is actually happening there. And, it's also a fundamentally political issue. This is from George and Tbilisi. But Saskia, perhaps you might want to link some of the comments.
Yeah. Right. Well, for one, cities are highly imperfect conditions in many, many ways. The inequality, the injustice, the poor who are neglected, et cetera, et cetera. We can just say that. Secondly, cities probably are, those who gain the most of it are those types of powerful actors, whether enterprises, political leaders, et cetera, et cetera, who can really benefit and just do what they really want to do. Then there is the third element. The third element is a vast number of people. And I'm now thinking especially about these huge cities, in Brazil, for instance, or in various parts of Africa and India, vast cities. Those cities are merely to the advantage of the privileged, because the rest pays a very high price for the jobs that they do, for the travels that they do, for the enormous lack of sleep. I mean, that is like a major issue in a lot of these countries. So my push has long been, we need to build more cities. The rich are not necessarily going to be interested in that project. They have what they need. It is the masses, the growing masses across the world, of very low income people who can barely make a living, and then on top of that have to sacrifice their bodies, one could say, not let alone their families. So we must confront that. And my question is, and Ricky, maybe you have an answer for that, why aren't we building more cities? I mean, we're building in certain rich areas of the world, we know that, right? The Emirates, etc. We're building cities there. But why in a rich country like the United States, like, these big Latin American also countries, why are we not building cities? Why do we expand existing cities rather than build new cities? That is a question that I would really want to pursue.
We're not going to get into that. What? All has to do with who owns the land.
No.
But Ruben, did you want to just come back on the issue of perhaps civic engagement?
Yes, quickly. I know we're running out of time and there are other questions there as well. Just pick up on what's been said already around civic engagement. I think clearly what we see in conflicted countries such as Mali is that there needs to be a real sense of local and national ownership of these interventions to serve the people they are meant to serve, at least on the surface. Sadly, what we're seeing, and certainly what I saw in Bamako, was that rather we end up with a set of, as Mary was saying as well, a set of different objectives, different sets of interventions that often have very little to do with, in this case, Malian objectives. Maybe about halting onward migration towards Europe, maybe about risks of terror attacks in Western countries, rather than local needs and understandings of the conflict and its historical dimensions. So that ownership is really important, I think. I think in the book, certainly the case of Bogota starts to look at that for us. Colombia being a site of a war on drugs and a version of the war on terror, and where there's been also a degree of pushback against that. And I think there are cases in the book, perhaps not Bamako, but certainly other ones, where we see some of that. Pushback and that very deep civic engagement, perhaps changing things over the long run. So I think I'll probably end it there.
Let me just put forward one last question, and then we can begin to wrap up. We have 8 minutes left. And this is a question which in a way does go back to perhaps, Mary, what you were even saying at the beginning, that you know we're looking at cities, we're not looking at camps in many ways. Because the question from Miruna Ciura, who's at the University of Bucharest, has a question for all of you. It says, we may consider migrant camps such as the one in Lesbos as city-like urban organisms. Can their remote character and enclosed, scrutinized nature be considered not war as such, but a hostility or a city under siege of sorts?
Interesting.
Well, I would say yes.
Go ahead.
Absolutely. And, you know, that's one of the features of contemporary wars. You know, cities contain green zones where the internationals live relatively normal lives, closely protected. But they include all kinds of zones. They include displacement camps, where the displacement people are all rather like in Lesbos, include detention centres where prisoners are kept. And there are all sorts of places in the city where criminalisation is rife. I mean, just going back to the question from David of Tbilisi, of course, don't get us wrong. We're talking about cities at war. We're talking about very violent cities, which are crisscrossed not only by political violence, but by criminal violence. But we're talking about little openings in those cities. We're talking about how do you solve the problems of those? And that's why maybe we are emphasizing the non-violent aspect of cities. But yes, I think those kind of enclosed spaces are something you find in war zones. And I also think one of the points about contemporary wars is that, you know, the difference between criminal and political violence is hugely blurred. Those that carry out war are usually violating not only international humanitarian law, but human rights law. So they're war criminals, but they're also involved in the sort of thing we regularly consider crime, drug smuggling, smuggling of antiquities, smuggling of diamonds, or whatever. So looting, pillaging. So all of these crimes are involved. And of course, they're large parts of the world, which are equally, if not more violent, particularly in Latin America, where we would not describe what was going on as a war. We call them drug wars, for example. But the level of violence, the level of deaths in places like Venezuela or Mexico is just as high as in Kabul or Baghdad, actually.
I think, Ruben, you make this very point that in Mali, one of the complexities about the nature of warfare, particularly for the interveners, so to speak, is that they don't know who they're fighting against, and that some of the key actors may change sides suddenly and unexpectedly. And I think you make the point that actually the opposition, whatever fragmented as it is more like working with works more like criminal syndicates. It's more like dealing with the mafia. I thought that was an interesting point you make there. And it's very much in the fragmented nature of war in cities that we've been talking about. Now, we're coming to the end, and I wanted to ask the three of you to just, in a way, increase our appetite for this great book, Cities at War, by reminding ourselves of that the extraordinary importance of the yogurt run story, which Mary started by recounting, which is probably one of the most optimistic narratives that one can have, right? And in many ways, that's why everyone, you hang on to it, because in many ways it gives you hope, right? Now, you would think, as also Saskia has alluded to, you know, the notion of war and the decimation of people's lives is not only there, but it's deeply depressing and deeply worrying. But there are a series of initiatives throughout the book, series of recorded testimonies by the different authors of the nine case studies, which are positive. That's what capabilities imply. It seems to me it's a positive capability rather than not. And I just wondered whether in these last literally closing minutes, if any of you, either of you or three of you, want to in a way remind us of one of these narratives which is as powerful as the yogurt run, so to speak. But literally you've got 30 seconds each before I wind up. Ruben, I'm going to start with you because I'm sure you've got one already.
You're putting me on the spot here. I'm trying to scramble through my memories. I might not have a great anecdote right now, but what I'm thinking of perhaps is not just the city in itself, a specific city, but relations between cities. We see this, and of course Saskia has also looked at this, and Mary, how in other fields as well, from climate change to migration politics, cities, whether individually or together, urban authorities have often led the way and pushed back against certain state-level policies. So I think also not losing track of that wider political dimensions to cities is very important in that picture. And I'll certainly be sure to find that good anecdote.
No, but okay, that's very helpful. But Saskia, for example, whether it's an anecdote or a concept that you come away with as I mean, I don't want to feed the lines. That would be the wrong thing to any of you. But the mere fact that you go from yogurt run and end up with tactical urbanism seems to be a very positive gesture. That, you know, you don't have to wait for mayors or governors, usually corrupt, to impose from above the wrong thing. So, Saskia, just 30 seconds on your takeaway.
Yeah. So one way of thinking about cities, and I'm talking now about cities that may be reasonably sized, not the huge, endless cities. It seems to me that, number one, it is really an important opportunity for people who live in the city, whatever, for the food they have, for the jobs they can have, for what they can give to their children, et cetera, et cetera. So there is a shared interest in having cities. This is a very important point. Now, we all know that there are people who hate cities and they're leaving for small towns, etc. Well, that is, I think that's the second point. That is an important issue. I think our cities should not simply keep expanding. That is only to the advantage of the rich, comfortable classes. It is not to the advantage of a lot of the low-income people who have these long trips.
I'm going to have to stop you at number two. Mary.
Okay.
Well, I just thought of two examples of what I think is tactical urbanism. One was when I went to Medellin. Saskia was talking about how poor people had to spend 2 hours getting to the center of town. One of the things that the mayor of Medellin introduced to change that was a funicular. So people could go in the sky on a 20-minute trip and avoid those 2 hours trying to get into the city, which was a hugely important peace initiative. And one of the things I found so fascinating was that while you're in the funicular, people have done wall paintings. So it is almost like a sort of film. You see one after the other, showing military guys taking off their uniforms and doing the washing up. And then my other example comes from Barcelona. I once asked Narcís Serra, who's known to Ricky and Saskia, about how he dealt with criminalization in the city. And he said what was really important was creating open spaces, creating parks and open spaces. So those are the kinds of security measures that we're talking about when we talk about tactical urbanism.
Yeah,
we're going to end our conversation here. We've run out of time. We've had a very attentive and careful audience, and thank you, all of you, for being part of this discussion and for sending in your questions and hopefully receiving some of the answers to those questions. This is the book, even better. Let's see whether we can get it done. There we go. And last thing to say is to thank not just the speakers and the organizers, but LSE Ideas, I want to repeat, hosted the event. The book is published by Columbia University Press, and there are many people there to obviously thank for having made it possible. The European Research Council funded the project at the outset under Mary's outfit at the LSE. And clearly, we want to end by not only thanking all the authors, the case studies in the book, Ruben being one of them, but the two editors and two of our three panelists, Mary and Saskia. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ricky.